The sun hangs low in the sky, its light reflecting off the sea. Gulls fly overhead. A lone rider rides across the cliffs along the seaside. It is Link, the Hyrulean hero, his goal a castle in the valley below. Inside the castle, Link moves slowly, with trepidation as he approaches the magical artifacts at the end of the Great Hall. Three magical triangles. The Triforce of Power, Wisdom, and Courage. The Triforces lift off their pedestals where they rest. Link is lifted off the ground. The world around him swirls and becomes indistinct. And suddenly, Link is gone, whisked off on his next adventure. This is Legendary Adventures, a Legend of Zelda playthrough podcast. I'm Paul Riley, a Zelda fan exploring the evolution of the series by playing through each of the mainline Zelda games in release order. This is Season 7, all about Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons. This week we're venturing through the opening of Oracle of Ages to explore the past and the present as we seek the essences of time. We'll find the first essence this week inside Spirit's Grave. After naming our Link and starting a game, we find ourselves in a forest. Completely unarmed and nowhere to go but up. As soon as we do, we find Impa, Zelda's nurse surrounded by Octoroks. She calls for help, and the monsters flee as Link approaches even though we have no weapons. Impa does not know Link, but notes he has a triangle symbol on the back of his hand denoting that he is a Hyrulean hero. This is a nod to the concept first introduced in Zelda 2, and prominently referenced in Ocarina of Time. She says the symbol must have scared the monsters. This is a story-heavy introduction. Impa looks strange with a blue color, but we accompany her all the same to find a singer named Nehru. As we travel, we'll pass by a couple of white monkeys. They share an appearance with the white monkeys of Majora's Mask. Even though this game is built from the engine and assets of Link's Awakening, we'll see plenty of influence from both Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask on the Oracle games. Impa asks us to push a stone with the triangle symbol out of the way. She won't touch it herself, only adding to the obvious wrongness of Impa. We move the stone and proceed past it. As we do, we can hear Nehru singing. We follow the song to Nehru. If we go the wrong way, the music changes back to the earlier tune. We will hear Nehru's song if we're on the correct path. We find Nehru in a small forest clearing. Animals and people surround her, transfixed by her song. It's very similar to Marin at Animal Village. If we speak to a bear twice, it will move aside, allowing us to get closer to Nehru. As we fill the gap left by the bear, we are shown a large still image rendered in a different style than the typical graphic showing Link listening to Nehru's song. Zelda-ness supervisor Yoichi Yamada said this touch is a showcase of the influence of Capcom on the game. We endeavor to retain the Capcom-ness of the games too. For example, the opening sequence has a large, single picture that pops out at you. That kind of presentation is something that only Capcom can do. We made sure we left in things like that. We speak with Ralph, a man who fancies himself a hero like Link, and the protector of Nehru. We learn Nehru asked Hyrule to send messengers when she learned that her country, Labrinna, would face many evils. She feels something evil is approaching, and so it does. Impa is revealed to be possessed by a sorceress named Varin, who then possesses the body of Nehru and travels to the past. We see some of the impacts of her time travel. The monkeys fade from existence. A child is petrified and turned to stone. Ralph rushes off on a quest to save Nehru. Impa explains that her goal was to take Nehru to Hyrule to protect her before she was possessed by Varin. She gives Link a sword, and our quest truly begins. If it wasn't clear already, Oracle of Ages is heavier on story than any other previous top-down Zelda game. It rivals the 3D titles. This may be in part an influence of the Nintendo 64 titles, but it's also likely an influence of the story-first approach Flagship took when designing this game. This opening is clearly story-focused, and that for me has made it kinda hard to delineate when and where the tutorial begins and ends. At this point, we're taking full control of Link and we have his sword, which could be marked as the beginning of the tutorial, although we did control Link for a bit prior and even participated in some activities that we'll be doing throughout the game, such as pushing the stone. So it all could be chalked up as a bit of a tutorial, I suppose. We head south and find Linna City. We have to cut through bushes on our way. We're restricted to taking this path towards the city. We will run into a dead end if we try any other direction. Linna City will be sort of a hub for our adventure throughout the game. It features homes and shops and is the dwelling place of the Maku Tree, a guardian spirit not unlike the Deku Tree seen in Ocarina of Time. We pass through a cave to reach the tree. We note that the cave is old in appearance and has several paths that are blocked off for safety reasons. The Maku Tree states Varen is trying to flood the land with the power of sorrow. She starts to explain how we can stop Varen, when the Maku Tree suddenly looks distressed, and then vanishes from existence. To the right of the Maku Tree, we find a time portal that Varen used to travel to the past. Ralph runs past us and into the portal on his quest to save Nehru. We follow. We are taken 400 years in the past. The music is different with new arrangements of themes that we heard in the present. Generally, the music that we'll hear in the past will be at a slower tempo than the music we'll hear in the present. In terms of visuals, there's more brown in the coloration of the world itself, giving it sort of a sepia tone-like feel. In place of Linna City, we find Linna Village, a smaller version of the city that we saw in the present. We are told that the village is covered in excess dirt because the queen ordered a tower to be constructed. The queen, Ambi, we are told was kind until recently. Traveling to the tower, we get another large story image showing the under-construction tower. We're told that this tower was originally planned to be a guide to Queen Ambi's love to safely return home from sea. Time, however, seems to have stopped with the arrival of Nehru, resulting in a never-ending day and unending work on the tower. The people have taken to calling it the Black Tower. Inside the tower, we meet several workers who say that they want to go home. A foreman mentions they're behind schedule. Outside the tower, a worker wonders why they're building something so big. It's just work, work, work. These comments were apparently put in by director Hidemaru Fujibayashi in reference to the crunch experienced by the team as they worked on this game. In a 2001 interview originally published on Nintendo.com, he said, "There's a dark tower in Oracle of Ages with many people who work there. Their dialogue is along the lines of, 'There's no end to this work,' or 'I can't go home.' There were also team members who couldn't go home much during development, so we put those characters in as a parody." He laughed. That said, Fujibayashi said that the feeling among those working on the game on the whole was positive. He continued, "But our team feels really cozy, so the general atmosphere was great. People who just come by with a message would end up in a meeting and chat with us for 2 hours before leaving again." Within the tower, one worker gives us a shovel. We can use it to quickly exit the tower again. There is a heart piece to dig up just outside, but I completely overlooked it and didn't come back to dig it up until later. We use the shovel in Linna Village to open the path to the cave that leads to the Maku Tree. In the past, the cave appears to be more well kept. It's something of a mini dungeon. We have to do some light puzzle solving and key hunting to make our way through it. The puzzles are relatively simple, just pushing a few blocks to open paths. The most complex pushblock puzzle involves pushing 3 blocks to reach a floor switch. The room is symmetrical and we can push 3 more blocks on the other side of the room to reveal a staircase to an optional rupee pickup. Nice! When we reach the Maku Tree, we see that she is being menaced by moblins. We defeat the monsters and win the love of the Maku Tree, who promises to marry Link when she grows up. This is perhaps a nod to Ocarina of Time, where Link got engaged to Princess Ruto. The Maku Tree opens a gate, allowing much quicker access to her location, and we use a time portal just outside the gate to travel back to the present. In the present, the Maku Tree manages to set aside her marriage plans just for a bit, so that she and Link can focus on the immediate needs of the land of Labrinna. Varen is manipulating Queen Ambi in the past in an attempt to reach the heavens and to throw the world into darkness. With the flow of time disrupted, the Maku Tree's memory is fading. She knows, however, the 8 essences of time are hidden in dungeons throughout the world, and that they will help her restore her memory and give Link the power to defeat Varen. The Maku Tree gives Link a seed satchel which contains 20 ember seeds. They can be used to burn small trees, enemies, and light torches. The ability to burn trees seems to be a callback to the original Legend of Zelda, and the selection of small trees that we could burn in that game. Here, the trees that we can burn have a distinct appearance, unlike the trees in the first game. From here on out, the Maku Tree will serve in a role that's very much similar to the owl from Link's Awakening. She's not a full-on companion character like Navi or Tattle, but just a step below that. Like the owl, she will occasionally interrupt the adventure and provide hints and direction. Players can review her hints at any time from the map screen. The Maku Tree will also provide the post-dungeon hints, which were provided by a disembodied voice in Link's Awakening. Before putting our new Ember Seeds to the test, there are a couple of things I do want to touch on. The first is Vasu Jewelers. The Oracle games each feature a number of rings which can be found in a variety of locations around the world. They each provide a variety of buffs or other benefits. Before they can be used, players need to take the ring to Vasu Jewelers to get it appraised. They then wear it by placing the ring in a box. It is another example of the Zelda series leaning into RPG elements in a simplified way. Players can customize their Link to a degree through the use of these rings. They can boost certain stats. I'm not someone who ever dug deeply into the ring system, but I generally did have a ring equipped at all times. The second new system here is the Gasha Seeds. These were introduced in the past in Linna Village. Players will find Gasha Seeds throughout the world. The seeds can be planted in soft soil patches scattered throughout the world. After a while, the seed will mature into a tree with a single large nut. The nut holds an item and the tree withers away after the item is collected, allowing for a new tree to be planted. How long it takes for a tree to mature will vary. It's based on the number of monsters that players kill. I don't know the exact numbers. On the north end of Linna City, there is a house with a green roof and two doors. This is the home of Blossom and Bippin. A side quest centered around their child is one of the most extensive in the game, and it actually crosses over between Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons. When we first meet them, they're not sure what to name their child. They ask us what the name should be. We can input any name we want. I asked my wife what she thought the name should be, and she said Stem, keeping in line with the plant theme. On a previous playthrough of Seasons, I chose Bud, thinking along those same lines. This time around, Stem it is. One more thing that I put in my notes. On the west side of Linna City is the home of the Know-It-All Birds. This is a tutorial repository much like the library in Link's Awakening or the Know-It-All Brothers house in Ocarina of Time. The big difference here is the location. Both in Link's Awakening and Ocarina of Time, players were sure to pass by these locations. They were located directly on the critical path. The Know-It-All Birds, however, are not. I didn't go to them or find their house until after I got the Ember Seeds, and that was only because I realized that I hadn't really spent all that much time exploring Linna City. To the east of Linna City, we can find some burnable trees. We passed by them on our way to the city. The trees block the entrance to Yol Graveyard, which holds the first dungeon of the game. Inside the graveyard, a gate leading to a path to the north is locked, forcing us to the south. As we move south, players are sure to notice stones that they will be able to lift with the right equipment. We also see the dungeon itself, but it's out of reach. At the southernmost point of the graveyard, we come across a group of kids who talk about a grave hidden under a tree. This hint probably isn't needed, but it nonetheless sets us on the right way to go. There are two burnable trees at a dead end. Burning one tree reveals a set of stairs leading underground. The grave is dark. We need to light two torches to reveal a key. As we do, a skull pattern is revealed on the floor. Spooky. With this key, we can open the gate to the north. The path starts heading north, but then actually loops us back down south to the dungeon. This is Spirit's Grave. The music of the dungeon is a short, off-kilter piece. The melody has a start and stop feeling to it. The pauses between phrases always feel slightly longer than I'm expecting, and other elements, such as a deep descending bass line, often come in during these pauses. It's a short track looping back to the start after about 15 seconds or so. Spirit's Grave is a horror-themed dungeon of the Halloween variety. The dungeon spans only a single floor. It is in the shape of a candle flame. Despite the shape and our use of ember seeds to gain access, fire is not used much within the dungeon itself. It's worth noting that the rooms of the dungeon are big. They aren't all contained on just one screen. The camera follows the player scrolling through the rooms. This stands in contrast to both Link's Awakening and the original Legend of Zelda, which generally limited room sizes to just a single screen. In the few instances where rooms were intended to be larger than what we could see immediately on the screen, they were still presented as single screen areas. These large dungeon rooms will be a common feature of all dungeons in this game. Players will not be able to take in a single room at once. It occasionally leads to slightly awkward moments. Producer Yoshiki Akamoto acknowledged this in an interview with a Japanese magazine that was originally translated and published on Nintendo.com. He said, "We realized that since the Game Boy Color screen is narrower than a TV screen, the player must scroll the screen to the left and right to see the whole room. That created some difficulties in the gameplay development. If you see a crack on a wall, you know you need to use a bomb to break through. But if you can't see the crack because all the walls in the room aren't visible at once, you could miss it. That could lead to more difficulty in developing the maps." Spirit's Grave is built on a loop. When we first enter, we cannot go left due to pots blocking the path. This forces us to the right. The path through the dungeon will first take us north, then west, then south, and east. There are two forks in the road. The first is found one room to the right and one room up from the entrance. There are exits to the north and the east of the room. Either way, we will have to go through a room that is two rooms east and one room up from the entrance to get the key. A second fork in the road is found on the northern end of the dungeon, roughly four rooms up and two rooms left from the entrance. We will ultimately travel in both directions, but we are intended to head south first. I actually went north first and reached a dead end in the form of the boss door. In this room, I was grabbed by a wall master and was sent back to the start. It's not fun to be grabbed by wall masters, but it turned out to be a good thing for me because I opened chests that I ignored the first time through. In those chests, I found the map and the compass. Notably, the compass features a chime that plays in rooms that contain a key, just like in A Link to the Past. It's worth finding in each dungeon. This dungeon introduces puzzles and mechanics that will be common in other dungeons in a simple way. In the first room with a forking path, we find a colored block like a dice. Players can push it to make it roll, changing the color that's on top. In this first instance of the puzzle, we really only see two colors, yellow and blue. We need to push the block into a space surrounded by torches with the blue side up to open a door. It's a straight shot and easy. There's really no way to mess this up, the game's just teaching the concept. The dungeon also introduces moving platforms used to cross gaps and in order to move forward or to reach chests. Later dungeons will use these for platforming challenges. Here we see them in their simplest form. We use only one at a time, and we generally walk straight on with good timing. Or we can jump from a raised platform with good timing and land on the platform. The mini-boss is a large ghost. We reach it by heading south through a locked door at the second fork in the road. It is fought in a large open area. The large ghost sends out three smaller ghosts which attempt to latch onto Link. If these small ghosts do manage to get onto Link, he will temporarily be unable to use his sword. There's no real trick to this fight, just hit all the enemies with the sword to deal damage. I didn't feel it was too hard. After defeating the mini-boss, a fairy and a portal appear. As in Link's Awakening, we can step through this portal to create a quick travel point between the entrance and the mini-boss arena. It comes in handy in this dungeon. Continuing south from the mini-boss, we'll be forced towards the dungeon item. We will have to light two torches with ember seeds, our only required use of fire in the dungeon, to reveal a staircase. It leads to a side-scrolling room laid out exactly like the side-scrolling rooms that held items in the original Legend of Zelda. There's a long ladder on the left and a short one on the right, which leads to an alcove that holds the item. In this case, the power bracelet. We can now lift pots, allowing us to open the path forward, which loops us back to the entrance. Along the way, we'll find the boss key in a chest surrounded by pots. At the entrance, we can use the mini-boss portal to quickly reach the northern end of the dungeon, and then head north to reach the boss room. The boss is Pumpkinhead. It's a ghostly figure in a white robe. Its hands are always outstretched like a stereotypical zombie. As the name suggests, its head is a jack-o'-lantern. This fight happens in a second large open arena. We hit Pumpkinhead's body with the sword until the body disappears. The head falls to the floor. Then, using the power bracelet, we can pick up the head to reveal a small ghost that was inside. We throw the head at the ghost to deal damage. I was knocked down to a single heart during the fight, but honestly, when it was over, I felt like the fight was pretty simple and not too difficult. In the northernmost room, we get our first essence. It's the Eternal Spring. We are told after death, this essence speaks across time to the heart. After getting the essence, the Maku Tree contacts Link telepathically. It's much like the mysterious voice that spoke to Link after each of the dungeons in Link's Awakening. The tree directs Link to the West Woods. We'll go there next week. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you want to follow along this season, please subscribe. And a big thank you to everyone who subscribed already. This podcast has earned more subscribers than I ever thought it would. And you are all awesome. I am Paul Riley, and I will see you next week.